In July 1997, Scottish Parliament planned a new building, and the estimates for the cost were set between £10 and £40 million. By June 1999, the budget for the building was £109 million. In April 2000, decision makers imposed a cap on costs, saying no further money could be spent beyond the £195 million mark. In 2001, a demand was made for all those involved to give a final expected spend figure, which they then set at £241 million. The project completed in 2004, costing in the region of £414 million. Perhaps in the hands of a more pessimistic group, things might have gone differently. Hello and welcome to the Big Happy Life podcast. I'm Natalie Britt and I'm a coach, trainer and hypnotherapist. Over the last couple of weeks, I've been talking about what it means to have a pessimistic explanatory style. And this week, I'm looking at what the benefits are of being a pessimist or thinking like a pessimist. Because after all, why, when it feels so bad and can stop us in our tracks and make us feel completely helpless, why has that type of thinking perpetuated? Why has it stayed with us? Why hasn't it died out? It must serve us in some way. And that's the question I aim to answer in this episode. In case you missed the previous two episodes, let me give you a brief recap about the hallmarks of pessimistic thinking as defined by Martin Seligman in his book, Learned Optimism, so that you know what I'm talking about when I talk about pessimistic thinking or a pessimistic explanatory style. So we look at it from two angles. First, in the case of unwanted events, something we might perceive as a failure or something that's gone wrong in some way. And then second, in the case of successes or things that have gone the way we wanted them to. So pessimistic thinking, either way, has got three hallmarks. And we call those personal, permanent, pervasive. So in the case of negative events, somebody with a pessimistic explanatory style would have personal being that they make the reason, the story for, and the explanation for why the thing happened personal to themselves. It's my fault. I'm too lazy. I'm not clever enough, and so on. Permanent would be that whatever caused the thing to happen will exist in the future too. So it's an obstacle now, it's an obstacle that caused this failure, but it's an obstacle that's going to stay and therefore cause future failures too. So I'm too lazy is a good example of something that's personal, but also has sort of permanence baked into it because it's seen as a kind of character trait or personality trait. Something like, my boss never listens to me is another one. So it's not that he wasn't listening today, it's that he never listens. So next time I try and talk to him, he won't be listening then either. Under the heading of pervasive, with pessimistic thinking, that means the situation is indicative of other situations too. So, for example, a failed maths test becomes school is too difficult. Now all subjects are lumped into that explanation. And technically, even the leisure time at school is lumped in there too. So if you then had the child have an argument with a friend at lunchtime, that fits into the school is too difficult rhetoric as well. So the difficulty of the maths test kind of bleeds out into other areas of school. It's not contained within the single situation. Then in the case of positive events, personal goes the other way. So instead of it's down to me, it becomes it's down to something outside me. I got lucky. I was in the right place at the right time. So in the pessimist's hands, the credit for the success is handed to someone or something else. And in so doing, none of the power or the empowerment associated with that goes to the pessimist, the thinker. And the same thing happens with permanence as well. So the pessimist then assumes that this is a temporary success, a blip, and therefore is not likely to be something that can be relied upon in future. It's kind of a fluke. So it's the footballer who scores and then says, well, you know, I got lucky. The wind caught the ball and sort of bent it into the net. And then with pervasiveness, this event stands alone. So a great score on a maths test is because the questions were easy. So there's no possibility for this win to spread into other subjects or even for it to spread into the next maths test because it was just a fluke based on lucky questions. So in the face of positive events, a pessimistic explanatory style leaves no opportunity for banking of energy or empowerment or self-belief. You don't carry anything forward into the next one. It sort of reminds me of my stepson. He used to play these computer games where the character would have to go into battle with an adversary. And if he won, he got to keep the weapon or the skill that the adversary possessed. And so he'd put it in his little backpack and he'd go on to the next level. When he got to the next level, the battle would be more difficult, but then he'd be carrying whatever thing he had collected from previous battles. And that's how it is for an optimist, where they sort of face the hardships, recognize the hardships, know that they're difficult, but in the way that they explain things to themselves, they keep building their resilience, their energy, their self-belief, and they start to see the successes as being explained by things that are pervasive and permanent. So things that can be repeated, things that can be relied upon for next time. So the optimist is repeatedly filling the backpack, going to the next battle and carrying more and more stuff, while the pessimist progresses through the levels, but the backpack stays empty. And so as the battles get harder, the pessimist becomes ever more likely to be defeated, while the optimist only gets stronger and more resourceful with each battle. Which brings me back to the question, why have we kept pessimistic thinking? Because surely all of us could benefit from being optimistic all of the time. But it turns out that's not the case. And the example I shared with you at the very beginning of this podcast is a great illustration of why. Of course, I absolutely cannot comment on the levels of optimism or pessimism within the group of decision makers on that project. I can use it for illustrative purposes, which of course I will do in this episode. But in terms of the question about why we've kept pessimism and what the benefits are, this episode is going to be really helpful for you if you are somebody who recognizes the hallmarks of pessimistic thinking in your own thinking. Then this episode can help you identify what your brain is trying to do to help you. And that can be the first step towards making peace with these thought patterns, rather than judging them or trying to force them out of the way and, quote unquote, think more positively. Ultimately, when you can choose when and how to adopt your pessimistic thinking style, it can serve you really well. And that's what this episode is about. So let's dive in. As the Edinburgh example shows us, our decisions and predictions can have massive costs to us, financially, mentally, and emotionally. I hazard there were a lot of stressed people on that project. If we assume that there was some quite optimistic thinking in those projections and in the decisions that unfolded that project, how might pessimists have done things differently and what might have happened? As I say, I can't comment on the levels of optimism and pessimism within the group of people, so I use this for illustrative purposes only. But the first benefit of pessimistic thinking or a pessimistic explanatory style has been shown to be that pessimists tend to be more realistic. In one study conducted in 2010 with 122 undergraduate students, they were tested to assess, first of all, whether they had an optimistic or a pessimistic explanatory style, and then they were asked to predict their performance on a subsequent task. Pessimists, although having a tendency to underestimate themselves, were more accurate with their predictions than the optimists were, who overestimated their predictions of their likely success. These sorts of findings have been replicated in lots of other areas of academic achievement, sports performance, and work-related tasks. And they were even replicated in a study by Seligman himself with a group of other researchers, They conducted an experiment to examine the relationship between explanatory style and realistic predictions in terms of job-seeking behaviors. So they got participants to predict their chances of finding a job within a specific time frame. The study found that individuals with a more pessimistic explanatory style tended to make more realistic predictions about their job search outcomes. They were more likely to accurately estimate how much time it would take for them to find employment compared to those who had a more optimistic explanatory style. So when you think about the realities of what it would take to budget for a household while you look for work, estimating how much time you're going to need in order to successfully get a job, what you need to do in the meantime to make sure everything works the way that it's meant to, having a more pessimistic explanatory style is more likely to have you make realistic predictions about what lies ahead and therefore make choices more cautiously about what you do between now and acquiring that job. And that's the second benefit of pessimistic thinking. Pessimists tend to be more cautious. But of course, this one's kind of a double-edged sword because with the realism of a pessimist, can you imagine the project proposal meeting? So we have this plan for a new building that's going to go up. It's going to take probably 5 to 6 years. It's going to cost somewhere between 415 and 430 million. Can we have a yes for that? You'd be like, I don't think so. That sounds like a really terrible project. So when it comes to taking risks and venturing into the unknown, perhaps we do need some optimism. But when it comes to making choices about being realistic, helping us make cautious choices so we can prepare for the future, particularly when we know that some challenge or difficulty lies ahead of us and that we are going to need to conserve our resources to make it through that, we stand a better chance by adopting a more pessimistic style, or at least we stand a better chance of being more accurate in our predictions of what lies ahead when we adopt a more pessimistic style. Now, when I think about something like starting a business, of course, we need optimism to be able to help us even take the leap in the first place. But where pessimistic thinking can come in handy is to think about, well, how long is it going to take me for this business to take off, for it to start making money, for me to have a steady flow of income, a steady stream of customers, and be able to kind of rely on this thing in almost an autopilot way? A pessimist is likely to estimate that time as being far longer than an optimist might. And for that reason, could potentially be far better prepared for the road that lies ahead. Another benefit of pessimistic thinking, kind of counterintuitively, is motivation. There was one study done by Norum and Illingworth. It was back in 1993, and they were studying something called defensive pessimism. This was almost like deliberate or chosen pessimistic thinking in preparation to achieve a goal. And so defensive pessimism was the act of deliberately thinking pessimistically about the goals that lie ahead in order to predict obstacles and some of the challenges and some of the likely failures and all of that stuff and prepare for it. And what the researchers found was that groups who did that were more likely to be motivated in the face of those challenges because they predicted them. And so having quite a pessimistic view up front can actually steel you against the difficulty that awaits you on the path towards whatever it is that you're going to achieve. And it's interesting, now I think about it, I've seen this play out in my own life from both sides of the camp. So one example I can think of is where I've spoken to friends or family members, I've done it myself actually, where we've been sort of blindly optimistic in the face of some difficulty. Like, you know, if I take an example, my mom was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes about a year or 2 years ago now. And she was like, nope, I am going to beat it. I'm going to reverse it. There's no way. I'm not staying on medication my whole life. Totally, totally reversing this thing. And at no point in the thought process or conversation was there any nod towards quite how difficult and challenging that would be, how many things would have to change, how disheartening it would be, and all the pitfalls and obstacles that would await her on that road. And I've done the same when I first started my business right back in 2012, where I was like, yep, I'm going out there. I'm going to offer my training services to the world. It's going to be amazing and I'm going to make a fortune. And I didn't think about, you know, what's it going to be like these first 6 to 12 months where nobody is going to be interested in what I have to offer, where I'm going to go virtually door to door, trying to drum up business, make a name for myself, get things moving, and it's going to feel like nothing is happening. The same actually with the adoption. And I know I've spoken about this so many times, but in the lead up to the adoption, I was like, yeah, I'm going to be an amazing mom, totally prepared, totally can do this. And I kept kind of glossing over the harrowing difficulty that every single social worker, every adoptive parent kept alluding to, but I was like, no, it won't be like that for me. And so when it was like that, I fell right into, yeah, the deepest depression I have ever experienced. And that, I think, is a really good illustration of, had I gone into it motivated enough to be honest with myself about what awaited me and be really, really deliberately, or as the researchers use, defensively pessimistic, maybe I'd have been more prepared and maybe it wouldn't have felt quite so bad when I hit the challenges that I hit. So yes, potentially massive benefit there. For those of us who do think naturally pessimistically, but who now could actually look at that pessimism and think, okay, how can I use these thoughts about all the difficulty that probably awaits me and prepare myself, use this to spur myself and get motivated to get to the point where I am not surprised by what awaits me, and I'm prepared for it in a way that strengthens me, makes me feel more resourceful, stronger, more capable. These are all things that allow us to, in those moments, perhaps switch our thinking from pessimistic to optimistic. Remember right back at the beginning, that element of personal? Imagine if you have deliberately allowed pessimistic thinking to come through in the preparation stages as you plan to achieve your goal. And then the things that you predicted happen, and you're able to say, ah, the reason I feel ready for this is because I was prepared. I was accurate about my estimation here, and now I know what to do. Now the explanation of how you get through it becomes something that's personal, and that is a hallmark of optimism. So perhaps allowing ourselves this and really deliberately choosing it can allow us to be more optimistic in the face of the challenges when they actually arise later on. And this sort of has another benefit rolled into it, which is preparedness. There was a study done in 2008 by Shepherd, Sweeney, and Carroll. It was titled Expecting the Worst: Anticipatory Pessimism and Stress Reactivity to Future Negative Events. So the goal of the study was to look at how people's pessimistic thoughts about the future affected their actions. They wanted to see if thinking about worst-case scenarios for upcoming negative events would make people more likely to take action to prevent those bad things from happening. What they found was really interesting, because it's true, pessimistic people did feel more stressed about the possibility of negative events. But surprisingly, for those people who anticipated the events, they were also more motivated to do something about it. So instead of just worrying and sitting back, the people who had been more pessimistic in their predictions were actually the people who were more likely to take steps to minimize the damage or the risks of the things that they had worried about. What I take from this, and actually all of the studies, is that pessimistic thinking, when it's chosen deliberately, can be strengthening and can actually motivate us and prepare us, make us more likely to make better decisions, prepare better for the future, and do things in a way that may actually increase the likelihood of our success in future. But pessimistic thinking does lead to increased stress levels. And when we think pessimistically without being deliberate about when to apply that type of thinking, it has the capacity to stress us out to such an extent that we feel helpless and do nothing. So from all of that, what I took from it as somebody with a pessimistic explanatory style is, A, it helped me understand how it's possible to be pessimistic and still achieve a lot, and for that to be part of what makes me strong and resilient. But I now also understand that what it means is that for those of us who have a more pessimistic explanatory style, we also have to have really good stress management techniques, because we quite naturally stress ourselves out. And if we can both manage the stress and choose when and how to adopt and make best use of the type of thinking that comes to us naturally, we have the capacity for this to become almost like a superpower, particularly if we can also improve our ability to think like an optimist when we need to. And that's where we're going next week, how to think like an optimist. I hope you found this episode beneficial, particularly if you are like me and do have a pessimistic explanatory style. I hope this episode has helped you see why it may actually be something really useful and fantastic. If you've enjoyed this episode, please do leave a review. It really pleases the algorithm gods and helps to get the podcast out to a wider audience. And if you would like to have the podcast and the show notes direct to your inbox each week, then visit nataliebritt.substack.com and click subscribe. It's free to do so, and all the updates come to you weekly straight to your inbox, so you don't have to do anything and you'll never miss an episode. And of course, you can subscribe directly within whatever podcast app you are using. That's it for me. That's it for this week. And for now, thanks for listening.